Continuing on in the book of Matthew, we're in Matthew chapter 20. We've talked about the first and the last a whole lot. Really, that's what we've talked about is, you know, those who are first are last, those who are last are first, right? So the question is if you're first, right? Now, we've got two of Jesus' disciples' mom comes up to him and he's like, hey, take my sons, put one on your right hand, one on your left hand. That's really what we've got here, right? It's James and John. So the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons. We're in Matthew 20, verses 20 to 23, 20 and following, right? It says, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down, making a request of him. And he said to her, what do you wish? And she said to him, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right hand and one on your left. But Jesus answered, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? They said to him, we are able. He said to them, my cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and my left, this is not mine to give, but is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. And hearing this, the ten became indignant with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Right? So, we see here a mother's love, right? That she loves her sons. She wants them to be thought of highly in the kingdom. So, she's coming to Jesus as a mother. Not as a follower, but as a mother, saying, hey, take care of my sons. We see mothers and their love for their children throughout the Bible, right? Hannah falls on her face and says, God, if you give me a son, I'll give him back to you. And Samuel comes. We see Mary meeting up with her cousin and John the Baptist, the fetus, John the Baptist, leaps in his mother's womb. Right? We see this love of the mother time and time and time again. And this is right after Elizabeth and Mary meet. Right? She sees Mary coming, and Elizabeth cried out with a loud voice, said, blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. How has it happened to me that the mother of my Lord would come to me? Jesus isn't even alive yet. He's still a fetus in the mother. How is it the mother of my Lord would come to me? She's already recognizing who Jesus is. For behold, when the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby leaped in my womb for joy. We know that the baby in Elizabeth's womb is John the Baptist. And the one in Mary's womb is Jesus. So the fetus is even reacting to this external stimulus. Crazy. Crazy. And blessed is she who believed that there would be a fulfillment of what had been spoken to her by the Lord. Right? She understands, hey, Mary, you've had visitors. Right? You've had visitors. And you believe in who is to come. You know, my husband, he didn't believe. He can't talk right now. So, she understands that Mary is blessed as the mother of the Lord. Children are a blessing. They're supposed to be a blessing. We're supposed to want the best for our children. Right? That's what this mother wants. This mother wants the best for her two sons. Right? Mary was blessed because of the baby she carried. It was a big deal. Right? She shouldn't have been a mother yet. One, she's young, but that wasn't what precluded her from being a mother. She wasn't officially married. Joseph hadn't built the home yet. She wasn't officially married. She's still, you know, promised to him at this point. The family still embraced her. This is her cousin. The family, the extended family, embraces her. They're like, we still love you. Even though, you know, you're having a child out of wedlock, we still love you. But Jesus her son, Mary's son, would be the one to save his people from their sins. Okay? That's why his name is Jesus, means salvation. Yeshua is salvation in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we see other mothers throughout, right? We've got Elizabeth, that's John the Baptist's mother. We've got Peter's mother-in-law. She plays a prominent role. Jesus heals her. What, Rosalind? Understand, but you got to understand what culture was like at that time, Roz.
Not like today.
Not like today. You had a child out of wedlock, that was, you could be stoned for that. Right? So we've got lots of mothers in the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Right? So we have Peter's mother-in-law. We have this mother. Let's fast forward a few years. We then have Monica, the mother of Augustine. She is worshipped for being a mother in the Catholic Church, right? All she did was pray for her son. That's what she did. She prayed for her son. She prayed that he would leave the bad teachings of the, you know, of each of the groups he got involved with throughout time, right? Notably the Manichaeans, right? But she wanted her best for her son. They wanted the best for their children, and that's what a mother is want to do, right? Mothers desire for their children to have the best life that they can give them. Fathers do too, but we're talking about a mother here. These mothers all angled for their children to have the best life, right? They're trying to take advantage of situations so that their children can have the best life that they can provide for them. Right. Elizabeth, right, she prayed for a child. She was barren for years. This is why, you know, John the Baptist's dad was mute until he was born. Right. This mother is doing nothing different. She's petitioning to Jesus that her son could have the best life. Right. Jesus says in John 14, right, how do we petition? Right? Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, otherwise believes because of the works themselves. Truly, truly, important, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these will he do because I go to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, that will I do, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. So she's just asking Jesus for something. Problem is that sometimes the answer is no. Jesus answers prayers. God answers prayers. Sometimes the answer is not what we want to hear. It's a no. Sometimes it's a I can't. Right? So why couldn't Jesus answer this prayer with a yes? Right. What we ask for from Christ must fall in the character of God. We can't ask for something out of selfish ambition. Right. I want to be thought of as better than everybody else. Right. That's not going to get answered with a yes. Right. We can't just ask something for as a magic trick, right? It's not a magic trick. Prayer is, it doesn't work that way. It's not like, hey, let me pull a rabbit out of this hat and I don't have a hat or a rabbit. This is communication with God, right? We're not communicating with a genie. Genie, I wish for $1 million, right? There's work that has to be done to get there, right? You say, hey, God, I want $1 million. Help me figure out how to earn $1 million, right? That would be, you know, a prayer. I don't know how well that's going to work for you.
Well, right? I think if God knows that you're asking for that money for the right reason,
yeah,
he would show you a way to do that.
Right, I agree. Right? So, you know, so why is Jesus going to say no to this? Well, it's out of selfish ambition. It falls outside of the character of God, right? So, we got to remember that the right hand represents deity, right? That's godliness. God, you know, those on the right, it's deity. It's the aggressive hand, the hand of growth and strength. The right hand laid upon a person conveys authority, blessings, power, strength, right? Right hand lifted to heaven is an oath or swearing, right? This is what they considered the right hand to be. This is this power and authority over here on the right side.
Yeah, it's funny. That hand is stronger than the left hand.
Well, if you're right-handed, sure. But if you're not. Right? But so authority is what she's asking for one of her children to have. Give him authority over everything. Jesus says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Right? That's a great commission. Matthew 28:18-20. Right? But the authority isn't to be given to an apostle. It's Jesus' authority. Jesus has authority in heaven and on earth. He says that very clearly. So, then she wants one on the left. She says, you know, put one on your right hand, one on your left. When you come into your kingdom, one on the right, one on the left. And while the right hand symbolizes the hand of blessing and mercy, while the left hand is the hand of the king and represents justice. So we have power and justice. Power and authority and justice. So she wants one of them to be the most just. Revelation 20, verses 12 to 15, he says, and I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. Right? Now, there are multiple places where it refers to the book of life. Some people want to say, oh, well, that's a different book of life. Well, no, we both use the very definitive the for it. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books, according to their deeds. Who is the one who judges?
Jesus.
Jesus is the one who judges. So justice comes from the left hand. That's Jesus. So these guys are saying, hey, I can do Jesus' job. That's the way the disciples are taking it. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. The death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So Jesus, he is the one with the authority. He is the one who meets justice. So God has already given these positions to Jesus. These are Jesus' jobs in the kingdom of heaven. And this mother wants her sons to basically have that job. Now, in and of itself, we think of it and we're like, oh, that's not a bad thing. Right? It's a little strange that a mother would ask that. But, you know, we want the best for our children. Well, what she doesn't understand, right, is that these positions are Jesus, right? And John writes, these things I have written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, so that you may know you have eternal life. This is the confidence which we have before him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the requests which we have asked him, right? We can ask anything, but sometimes what we're asking is not God. It's not, you know, something that God is willing to give. Now, atheists, you know, they turn this into a gotcha moment, right? Can God make a rock too big for him to lift? I've heard this a number of times. Right? Can God make a rock too big for him to lift? if he can, then he's not all powerful. He's not all powerful if he can make a rock that he can't lift. And if he can't, then he's not almighty. It's about this rock. Is it too big?
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this is in the logic of it, right? It's called a modal fallacy. Either way, right, as is common in paradoxes, the answer is bad. It's like the question, have you stopped beating your dog yet? What would you say? Well, no. I don't beat my...
I get it. If you say no, you're bad, and if you say yes, you're bad.
Yeah, because you were beating your dog.
No, I never beat my dog.
Right. But it's a yes or no question.
No, I'm not
right?
answering a yes or no question.
Well,
not.
That's what I'm saying is that they make this so that it's inescapable. Right?
No, for right? that I would ask that. To that I would say,
right.
you would
demonstrate. So the same right? thing here, right? If only the Almighty could create this rock, if only the Almighty could create a rock, right? Then he's already moved it. So thus, it can't be too big for him. If there is a rock that exists that he didn't initially make, then he's not the creator. Either way, what they have posited is not the God of the Bible. Right? What they're creating in their paradox is not the God of the Bible. And it's not like I had to search hard for this. Right? This is from the American Atheists. Right? The Association of American Atheists. It's not like this was hard to find. This is actually a question they put on their page. It's inconsistent. It's logically invalid. And he says, can you take of this cup? Can you take of the cup that I'm giving? But God demonstrates his own love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. Can we take of that cup? For if while we were his enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only this, but we also exult in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received the reconciliation. That's Romans 5, 8 to 11, right? John and James, these are the sons of Zebedee. They didn't die for the sins of the world. Not capable of it. Neither of them were separated from God by other people's sins. Sure, by their own. Neither of them was sinless. Only one of the two was even martyred. John, they say, lived to an age and died of old age. He wrote 5 books of the New Testament. The bottom line is they did not fit the bill of the lead role. They were not the ones who God had designated to die for the sins of the world. They just weren't. Wasn't who they were, right? They couldn't take of this cup. In Isaiah 51, 17 and 22, he writes, rouse yourself, rouse yourself, arise, O Jerusalem. You have drunk from the Lord's hand the cup of his anger. This is God's wrath. The chalice of reeling you have drained to the dregs. You've gotten to the bottom of it. Thus says the Lord, says your Lord, the Lord, even your God, who contends for his people. He fights for his people. Behold, I have taken out of your hand the cup of reeling, the chalice of my anger. You will never drink it again. I'm not going to make you drink of the cup of my wrath again. Well, who will? Right? God said that he was going to take it. God told his people that he would take their cup of wrath. And he did. On the cross. Christ took of that cup of wrath. He fulfills this very prophecy clearly, right? Only one person could take God's wrath for the sins of the people. And Jesus does that. In Luke 22, Jesus is praying in the garden and he says, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. right? The cup of anger, of wrath. Yet not my will, but yours be done. He knows what God has to do. He desires it not to be that way. He knows what has to be done in his life to fulfill the prophecies that have been set forth, specifically this one in Isaiah. But he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be separated from God even for a second. Yes, Rosalind. There is no other way.
The wages of sin is death.
The wages of sin is death. The gift of God. Right? We understand that the wages that we've earned are death. So Christ had to die for us once for all. No, because that is what the Bible speaks of. That the wages of sin is death, right? Think back to Genesis 3. Think back to Genesis, right? So the Adam and Eve, right? If they eat of the fruit, what happens? Yeah. So the wages of their sin was death. The wages of every sin throughout history has been death. If God is going to take all of that sin, what does he have to do?
They didn't die.
They did. They died.
They kicked out of paradise.
They died.
They died in their spirit.
Eventually, they died.
I know, but they didn't die like Jesus died.
Right.
They didn't die. They would. Everything that was taken from them, and they had to, you know, they were in misery. They could have been in paradise, but they were in misery.
And they eventually died.
Yes.
There was no death until they took of the fruit. Right. There was no death. They were mortal. No, they became mortal at that moment. Right? Meaning they were capable of dying. Right? No, because they saw the first human death was
getting to live eternally with God.
The first human death was when Cain killed Abel.
When that happened, then we became mortal to mortal death, which we wouldn't have had if they didn't sin.
So, you know, they said, we are able. Are we really? In Luke 9, Jesus says, and he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. What is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself, his soul? Right? So sort of, we kind of sort of can, right? We will be persecuted for our faith, right? Jesus doesn't say we might be. He says we will. We will undergo trials of various kinds, right? We will suffer for his name. That will happen. We're going to be ridiculed. Well, here's why it's sort of. We won't be killed for all sin. For all sin done by all people for all time. Only one could do that. We will not be referred to as God in the flesh, though there are people out there who want to say that we're all little gods. That's a weird one. Maybe we'll talk about that someday. And we will not take the full wrath of God. We won't. We're not capable of doing that. Only God himself could do that. And they disagreed, right? The disciples, the other 10, they're pretty ticked off, right? They're upset. Well, it's not the only time it happened, right? When Caiaphas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. This is Paul writing about Peter, right? Because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. Why did he stop eating with the Gentiles? Because it was wrong? No, because he feared the party of the circumcision. He was afraid of what they would say, of what they would do. It wasn't because he had missed the truth, it's because they were going to say bad things about him. Right? The rest of the Jews joined him in their hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. Right? Even Barnabas, guy who's traveled around with Paul to all these Gentile cities, preaching the gospel, even he becomes, like, carried away by it. He's like, oh, yeah, Peter's probably right on this one. I think I'm going to side with him. Paul's going, what are you people doing? But when I saw they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Caiaphas, Peter, in the presence of all, if you, being a Jew, live like the Gentiles and not like the Jews, how is it you compel the Gentiles to live like the Jews? You're a Jew. You don't live like a Jew. How are you going to come and talk to the Gentiles and say, hey, you guys, you have to live like Jews? He's like, this is inconsistent, Peter. You might want to figure this out. So Peter and Paul, they didn't always see eye to eye. They did not always get along. Remember, when Paul was first saved, Peter didn't want to have nothing to do with him. He's like, No, that dude's here to kill me. I ain't having it. They were sent to different groups. This was not about disliking a person, right? There's a difference. We've got to remember that. There's a difference between disliking a person and disliking an idea. We can talk about an idea all day long. And we can say, hey, this is terrible. What you believe here is wrong. That doesn't mean we're talking bad about the person. We've got to get that out of our thoughts. Hey, this person is saying that my thoughts are wrong. They're not saying that you are a bad person. They're saying that your thoughts are wrong. There's a difference there, all right? And we have to do the same. We have to be ready, willing, and able to call out bad ideas, bad teachings, bad thoughts, right? Hey, you're in the wrong spot on that one. We've got to be ready to do that. But that doesn't mean we say, you know, oh, this person's a terrible person. Just because they got bad ideas doesn't make them a terrible person. Makes them a person who holds to bad ideas. There's a difference between those. Right? We see the authority that Jesus has. You know, he talks about his authority multiple times. Right? In Ephesians 6, Paul writes, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so you'll be able to stand firm against schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Why do we put on the armor of God? Because we're going against people? No. Because they're bad ideas. He's saying the rulers of this world, that's not who we got to worry about. We've got to worry about Satan and what he's doing. Right? Rulers in this world, they're going to do what they're going to do. Right? They're going to do their thing.
Does that mean we shouldn't pray over them?
That doesn't mean we shouldn't pray for them, right? But it means that they should not be the focus of our angst. Right? Our war is not against them. Our war is against bad ideas. Our war is against teachings that are against Christ. Our war is a spiritual war. It is not a physical war. We see this in 2 Corinthians 10, right? Paul writes, and he says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not in the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. That's what Paul writes. Our war is not against rulers. It's against bad teachings about Jesus and God. That's what our war is against. Our war is one that is won with words, not a war that is won with swords. Jesus, remember, talks to Peter and he says, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. We have to remember that our war is against bad ideas, against bad teachings, against speculations that are raised up against the knowledge of God. And Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, right, that people don't have a knowledge of who God is, and whose fault is that? He says it's to your shame. So if you're not breaking down bad ideas, something I always like to say is ad hominem. That means attacking a person in word form. Ad hominem is the last resort of one who is soundly defeated by logic. We can win, right? We do see that our fight is not against flesh and blood. It's not against people. It's against ideas. It's against speculations. It's not physical. It's against metaphysical. Things that are beyond the physical. Like things you can't touch. But things you can grasp in your mind. He continues. And he says that, the rulers of Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. Right? But it's not to be this way among them. We want to talk about greatness. The only thing that is great is Christ. He's the greatest. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God." Don't be afraid, Mary. God's on your side. You found great favor with him. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son. And you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. Mm-hmm. His kingdom will have no end. There will be no end to the reign of Christ. We talk about this 1,000-year reign in the book of Revelation, but it says his kingdom has no end. That's on earth. Right? That the 1,000-year reign. Jesus never stops being king over all heaven. Right? He is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. His greatness is beyond anything we'll ever see. Before his birth, his supremeness is seen. Right? We see his greatness even before his birth. We see John leaping in his mother's womb. His mother even recognizes who Mary is just by the sound of her voice. And she says, "Blessed are you because you're carrying God in your womb." At baptism, we see his greatness, right? God speaks and says, "This is my son with whom I am well pleased." At 12, he's in the temple teaching. And the teachers are all amazed at the understanding of this young man. They see his greatness then. During his preaching, his healings, his greatness is seen. People understand that these are not teachings from God, from man, but from God. His greatness continues to be seen. He says, if you want to be considered great in the kingdom, be a servant. Serve others. Then he poured water into the basin, began to wash his disciples' feet, wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. So he came to Simon Peter. He said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" This is a servant's job at dinner. Right? They come in, they kick off their sandals, and the servant washes their feet before they sit down to eat. Here's Jesus. They've all kicked off their sandals. He comes in and he's washing their feet. And he says, "Lord, Lord, Master, do you wash my feet? As in, that's the servant's job. Jesus answered and said to him, what I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter. You're going to understand what's going on with this. You're going to understand why I do this. Peter said to him, never shall you wash my feet. It's beneath you. That is beneath your station in life, Jesus. Don't wash my feet. Jesus answered, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. If I don't serve you, then you're not part of those who believe in me, those who know me. If I don't do this, there's bigger problems, Peter. And Peter, being as Peter is off to do, he says, Lord, then don't wash only my feet, but also my hands and my head, right? Oh, okay, well, let's take this beyond that, and let's go where we want with it, right? Peter, common, sticks his foot in his mouth. Exactly. His clean foot in his mouth, right? But Jesus is our model in this. His service of his disciples should be a model to each and every one of us. If we want to be the first in the kingdom, we have to treat ourselves as though we are last on earth. We have to be ready, willing, and able to serve others. And if he was able to serve others, why can't we? Are we on a daily basis ready to serve others? Are we looking for others to serve us? We're looking for others to take care of us. Now Jesus, he's the Son of Man. The Son of Man came to serve. From there he went out, began to go through Galilee, did not want anyone to know about it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. When he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. They did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. The Son of Man, he's going to be killed. He will suffer. Jesus' service, it wasn't accepted by society. Society didn't care what he was doing. They didn't want him there. His service led to his death. His being so willing to serve others and care for others led to him eventually dying. This should be what drives us to serve, though. As we want to be like Jesus. We want to take up our cross daily and follow him. Do what he did. Serve others. This is why we should seek to serve all. We have to love others as Christ loved them. Right? How did he love them? He loved them in many, many ways. He gave them the truth. He fought that battle. At 2 Corinthians 10, right? We bring them knowledge of who God is. And he served them. He was willing to be a servant, even though he was the greatest. 1 Peter 4, he writes, be hospitable to one another without complaint, as each one has received a special gift. Each one. If you have been saved by God, you have received a special gift. You have a gift. God has given it to you. Employ it in serving another. One another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Whoever speaks is to do so as one who is speaking the utterances of God. Whoever serves is to do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Right. We have to be ready, willing, and able to serve others with the gifts that God has given us. Right? He's given each of us gifts. Gifted in many areas in life, right? Some are good at teaching, some at learning, some at understanding the difference between what is good and bad teaching. Some at, you know, faith. Some have more faith than others. Some have more knowledge than others. Right? The question isn't, do I have a gift? It's, are you willing to bring it to the table? Are you bringing that gift to the table for others? Some of them, service is a gift. Right? The gift of helps. Of helping others. We need to share our gifts with those in the church because they are for the building up of the body of believers. That's what our gifts are for. To build up the body of believers. Our gifts allow others to grow. In some way, shape, or form. No matter how big or small that gift is, it allows other people to grow. And when we look at these gifts, when we look at everything that we see in these gifts, we see that God has this desire for us. Oh, wow. We see that God desires each of us to perform in such a way as to build up the rest of the body of believers. And when we build up this body of believers, they can do things beyond anything we had ever hoped for, beyond anything we could ever see, we could ever think. We will conquer. We're not going to conquer with swords, with spears, and with shields, and with armor. We're going to conquer by the hope that God has given us each and every day to bring His world